From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, born in Africa and then moved to Detroit, Tunde Wey wants his food to get you thinking about racial inequality.
It is problematic that a scene that represents a city that is overwhelmingly black is overwhelmingly white.
A big honor for the Michigan business leader using her skills to help people in conflict regions like Afghanistan.
You know, a hungry man is a dangerous man, as I've always said. And we've got to give them something other than conflict to focus on.
A Michigan Holocaust survivor takes us to Nazi-occupied Amsterdam.
We had a curfew. We were barred from all public places. Theaters, movies, parks, libraries, swimming pools.
Those stories and much more for you today on Stateside. Hello and welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Coming up later in this hour, a Michigan business leader wins something like a Nobel Prize for Business for training women in conflict zones.
You know, I can work a heck of a lot faster than the U.S. government.
But first, with the weather warming up and the sun chasing away memories of that long, dreary stretch of cold, icy weather that dragged on well into April, many Michigan communities are now ramping up for tourist season, the season that's the economic lifeblood of many areas in Michigan, like Ludington. Last year was a strong, successful tourist year for Ludington and for Mason County. Let's talk about what that means as we say hello to Brandy Henderson, Executive Director of the Ludington Convention and Visitors Bureau. Brandy, is it fair to see tourism as the economic lifeblood of cities and towns like yours?
Yeah, absolutely. I think when you have a lakeshore community like ours in Michigan, tourism is one of those top industries and certainly is the backbone of many of our small businesses really rely on the tourism and the economic impact that tourism brings to our area, for sure.
When you stop and you kind of look at reports and numbers, and we see overall tourism's growing in Michigan. Last year, more than 5.6 million trips were made to Michigan from outside the state. And those visitors spent $2.1 billion in towns and cities and local businesses, just like you described. And I'm interested, as you look at your visitors coming to Ludington, people coming from outside Michigan versus Michiganders coming to visit Ludington, so intrastate versus interstate, what do you get the most of?
You know, we try to track our visitors in terms of zip codes. We certainly see a lot of Michiganders who are moving, you know, through different vacation destinations within the state. A lot of having to do with the SS Badger being our cross connection across Lake Michigan to Wisconsin. We certainly see a lot of travelers from Wisconsin, Chicago, Indiana, and Ohio as well. So any of those driving states, we certainly see a lot of traffic too.
When we look at numbers showing that last year was a strong, successful tourism year for all of Mason County, and even the year before, the MEDC put Mason County on its list of counties with the highest tourism growth in 2016. So a couple of straight years of growth. Why do you think tourism is on the rise?
Well, I think, you know, as you know, our economy has bounced back, people are certainly feeling more comfortable spending on vacations. But I think also, you know, we have been trying to do a really good job here in Ludington and Mason County talking about all the great things that families can enjoy here, not just in those really warm summer months at the beach, but fall travel, spring travel, and even things to do in the winter. So I think we're just doing a better job of talking about our area as an all-season destination, not just a July or August beach vacation.
And we're talking about things that are fun to do, but I've got to imagine there's a lot of serious work that goes into crafting what you're going to offer and how you're going to let people know about it.
Yeah, I mean, that is our job as a Convention and Visitors Bureau, is to market, promote, and really tell our story. And so, you know, that's our day-to-day job, and we do that 365 days a year. So, yeah, there's a lot of thought process into that and really explaining and trying to find ways, you know, to kind of set yourself apart, but also kind of share that experience with people who aren't here to see it for themselves, but really inspire them to vacation here.
Now, my understanding, am I right, you are a born and bred resident of Ludington?
Yes, I am, yep.
So give me a sense of what it was like when tourism was really at its lowest. What did that mean for the town? What happens when people stay home?
when people stay home, I mean, you have businesses that might close maybe a month or two in the winter. You know, you see maybe some of these really dependent businesses having to close their doors. We thankfully, you know, in those really tough years, still had a really strong travelers coming to the lakeshore. So, you know, having really warm summers and things like that really help to kind of keep that economic impact so that people can stay open year round. So, you know, as someone who lives here year round, we enjoy a lot of things because people come here and visit a lot in the summer. So certainly has an impact when people are staying home and not traveling. But we've been really thankful. You know, I think always Lake Michigan is a great attraction. And so we're really fortunate to be able to market that and be home to that as well.
I do have to note, we have seen gasoline prices take kind of a jump in the last week or so. I noted prices above $3 a gallon on my drive to work just this morning. Do you worry at all? Do you keep that eye on gas prices?
A little bit, yeah. I mean, you always think about what are those kind of hurdles that families and people who are looking to vacation might come across, and certainly gas prices are one of those. We know that we have a strong tourism base, you know, within driving distance of here. So, you know, those gas tank away type trips. And so we really try to keep Ludington at the forefront of all of those destinations as well.
Brandi Henderson is the executive director of the Ludington Convention and Visitors Bureau. Looking ahead to some summer weather, and finally got that that nasty cold start to spring in the rearview mirror.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely.
Brandi, thanks for speaking with us.
Yeah, thank you.
You're listening to Stateside, and if you miss any part of today's show or you want to give it a repeat listen, you can find it on our podcast. Just go to michiganradio.org and click on podcast, and you'll get the link.
What are we going to do?
Road trip.
This weekend, an automotive freak parade stretched from the streets of Detroit to the backwoods up north. Michigan Radio's Tyler Scott rode along in the backseat of a 1998 Jeep for some off-roading, a little recklessness, and a lot of fun.
It's the second year for the Gambler 500 in Detroit, and piece-of-junk cars lined up bumper to bumper for like half a mile. There's an old Buick painted up like NASCAR legend Jeff Gordon's famous number 24 car.
This is the Jeff Gordon. It's a modified Buick Century, and we have never owned a convertible before, so we figured we'd turn it into one.
How'd you guys cut the roof out?
Sawzall.
There's a guy in a blow-up T-Rex costume standing outside a Jeep spray-painted to look like a car from Jurassic Park. Yellow and green and red with stenciled logos, plus a loudspeaker and a light bar. Three young guys living in Detroit bought the Jeep for $460. Teams are supposed to spend less than $500. They call it the Jeep because one of the E's is missing from the hood. And it's their first time at the Gambler 500.
We just stumbled upon it on the internet like 2 months ago, and then we decided we would make the irresponsible decision of joining.
Vincent Marcella and his friends Mike and Max take off with the rest of the Gambler cars, ready to head for the first few Detroit checkpoints on the route. Vince eventually pulls up on dozens of cars lined up at a partially flooded vacant lot. We get to the front of the lot, and these guys are amped. We speed through, and a wave of city mud comes flying over the car.
Oh my God.
Then the Jurassic Jeep slips into a ramen joint for a quick lunch. Mike Lee is co-pilot, and he's anxious to get up north.
Looking forward to seeing how well the Jeep does in the mud, because we've never really taken it off-road yet. So,
Vince, Mike, and Max Sobel, the guy in the T-Rex costume, slurp down their ramen, and a caravan of gamblers takes off north on I-75. 3 hours later, we're surrounded by the hardwood and conifer forest near St. Helen, Michigan. We turn down the first off-road trail to see nothing but blue sky, forests, and lots of sunshine. But nobody knows quite where to go. Not anybody in the Jeep or the car next to it.
I don't know which way is which.
Yeah, we don't know either. We're trying to pull up a satellite portion
of
the map.
Like nothing.
You got nothing?
Yeah.
Well, what's the worst that'll happen, right?
Hey, there's at least two of us. Right?
Exactly, there's at least two of us. Do it, dude.
It's a long afternoon of riding trails through the mud and sand and watching more than a few people get stuck. Plenty of gamblers end up broken down. The organizer for the Gambler 500 says more than 800 cars came. Overnight, a lot of them camp out in the state forest. Mike, Vince, and Max have a few beers and end up sleeping overnight in the car. They report 20-degree car sleep isn't that great. But the next morning at breakfast, these guys want to hit the trails again.
I would say there's been less on-trail time than I expected there to be, but it's still been a blast. Like, I've had a lot of good fun. You can take a car that you don't care at all about, but there are just tons of other people here in the exact same place doing the exact same thing with the exact same level of car, and so it kind of takes a lot of that risk out. There's that safety net. You can really have fun. There's that community.
They take off ripping through the countryside again after breakfast, and deep in the woods, Vince finds the steepest part of any trail they've seen. There's even some snow still on it, but the Jurassic Jep has proven trustworthy.
I think Jep can make it.
I have confidence in Jep.
It actually ends up taking a couple tries, but this is the crowning moment of this year's Gambler 500 for this team. After two failed attempts,
we're coming up again.
Vince hammers the gas, hits the hill, and sends a bunch of mud and snow flying backwards.
Oh yeah,
got it.
Oh yeah.
But they get it all the way to the top.
Yes! The Jep!
The whole weekend, the Jep didn't meet a trail it couldn't beat. There's an awards ceremony at the end of the day. Then everybody heads home. And before they even make it back to Detroit, Vince, Mike, and Max are already planning what the paint job should be for next year's Gambler 500 car. For Michigan Radio, I'm Tyler Scott.
I hope you will join me when Stateside hits the road for a live show from Grand Rapids. We'll be at Celebration Cinema North this Thursday evening, May 3rd, and we would really love to have you there as part of our audience. Register to attend and get all the details, and it's easy. Just go to the Stateside page at michiganradio.org. Coming up, a series of pop-up dinners where the experience is tailored not to your palate, but to your privilege.
The idea for the pop-up and the idea for the other events that I am doing is to explore power.
That is in 10 minutes, right here on Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. I'm Cynthia Canty. Think of it as sort of a Nobel Prize for businesses, the Oslo Business for Peace Award. The Business for Peace Foundation every year honors business leaders who use their skills to do good, to help the economy, help society, and do it in a way that's ethical and responsible. This year's winners hail from Ireland, from Colombia, and Southeast Michigan. Lori Blaker is the CEO of TTI Global. It's headquartered in Bloomfield Hills, a staffing, training, research, and consulting company that operates in more than 24 countries on five continents. But it's what Lori has done with women in conflict regions like Kabul, Afghanistan, that has won her the Oslo Business for Peace Award. And she's with us now. Lori Blaker, welcome and congratulations.
Thank you, Cynthia. It's really quite an honor. Thank you.
You are now in the company of the likes of past winners such as Richard Branson and Elon Musk. How does that feel?
A little bit overwhelming, to tell you the truth. It's just mind-blowing. It really is.
First, before we talk about the Oslo Business for Peace Award, tell us a little more about your company. And am I right that it was actually begun by your parents?
Yeah, actually, my dad started the company back in the late 70s, early 80s, and that's when the electronics was really starting to hit the automotive industry, and he wrote service manuals for the automotive manufacturers here in the Detroit area. So that's kind of how we got our start, and I was his first full-time employee.
And here you are. So what do you do with the company? Tell us the kind of work the company does.
We would develop and design training programs that focus primarily around retail and after-sales operations. So we work a lot with dealerships. We train salespeople. We train technicians on how to fix your car. You know, we work with dealer principals on improving the profitability of their operations. And we do that, as you said, on five continents around the world.
And how did that work you're doing with your company drive you toward the work you're being honored for that you're doing with women in Afghanistan, in India?
Oh, gosh, it was a long journey, let me tell you. And I primarily got involved in supporting women and women's organizations just because of my involvement in the automotive industry. And, you know, back when I got started, you didn't see too many women working supervisory or management positions within the manufacturers or even the suppliers. So just some of the things that I think I experienced on the way through and the way up influenced me and my focus on supporting other women and helping them grow and develop. But I had been working quite a bit in India and with other women's organizations, and I happened to come across a group of women that were supporting Afghan women. And these Afghan women would actually go through a training program in Afghanistan, and then they would come over to the United States at the end of the program to get a little bit more, additional training. And then also they were partnered up with American women, and they actually, I had a young woman come and stay with me. She actually lived with me for about 10 days, and she job shadowed not only, you know, my career, my life, being a mother, running a household. So they actually get a chance to experience life as an American woman. And just some of the horror stories that I heard from her really pressed me to get more involved. And then I was actually invited to join the first U.S. trade mission to Kabul, Afghanistan back in 2012. And so I went. And it was just a really eye-opening experience. And, you know, I looked around and thought, geez, you know, what can we do to help? And that's how this whole project got started.
And I know you've got training and an automotive training center going in Kabul. How do you see that impacting the lives of women there?
Because I actually have women that are running the business. They traditionally can't be technicians because, you know, just wouldn't be allowed still even yet today. So I was trying to think of a way, how could I get them involved and how could I get them some experience and some development. So we started the program, and I actually have women that are managing and running the operations, and you still have men in the more traditional technical jobs, but the women basically run the business for me.
What do you think, now that you've worked with women living in conflict areas and areas with, you know, a tough economy, how can we build more bridges between ourselves and them?
I really think that the key to it all is commerce. You know, we've got to develop industry in these conflict zones, and there's got to be an opportunity for these people to work. You know, when you've got starving people, you've got big problems. You know, a hungry man is a dangerous man, as I've always said. And we've got to give them something other than conflict to focus on. You know, if they've got a roof over their head, food on the table, and an education, life's 100% better than being out fighting with the Taliban or ISIS. So we've got to give them something else. And until we can get industry and commerce established, you know, we're spending all this time and resources and lives in these conflict areas, and I just don't see it doing any good until we can get that established. So I just think it's critical.
And it seems that certainly you're a living example that business bears responsibility for furthering peace and justice in the world.
Oh, and I think we can do an enormous amount of good. You know, I can work a heck of a lot faster than the U.S. government. I can move somewhere and get something launched and, you know, plans developed and work moving forward so much quicker than a government could. You know, because we've got our feet on the street and we're right out there in society working with the different cultural issues and working with the people on the ground, we can see, you know, readily what's going on and what needs to happen. So I just think we're in such a great situation, and we should be doing more of that.
Lori Blaker, you're off to Oslo next month for the awards ceremony. What does getting the Business for Peace Award mean toward furthering your work with women in Afghanistan and India?
That's a really good question. It's more than just the award and what does it mean and, you know, what's it going to do as far as helping promote. To me, it's like a lifetime achievement award, because so many times, you know, I'd be focused on supporting this project in Kabul, and then we've got others in India that we help support. But you know, everybody would look at me and say, you know, why are you doing this? You know, why aren't you focusing somewhere else? Why aren't you focusing more on, you know, just on your business in general, which I do, but you can always find a little bit of time to focus on something that helps these women in this particular conflict zone. So to me, it's just kind of a reaffirmation that, you know, no, I wasn't crazy, and yeah, I'm on the path that I was meant to be on, and I'm doing the things that I was meant to do, and still managing my business and growing my business. So to me, it's just it just represents that you can do both. You can be successful at both, and more of us should be considering, you know, how can we get involved and how can we do that?
Lori Blaker, CEO of TTI Global, headquartered in Bloomfield Hills. She will receive the Oslo Business for Peace Award next month at a ceremony in Norway. Congratulations, Lori. Thank you so much for speaking with us.
Oh, thank you, Cynthia. Thank you so much.
You know, there is so much to talk about in this big, diverse state of ours. We can't possibly know about it all. And that's where you come in. We want to know what you're curious about. If you've got a question about Michigan, something or somebody you've always wondered about, send it along to us. Just go to the Am I Curious page at michiganradio.org. No one has too much trouble envisioning comfort food, but what do you think of when I say discomfort food? That's what Tunde Wei will serve up with the pop-up restaurant he's running from May 2nd to May 5th inside the community space Bank Sui in Hamtramck. Tunde Wei emigrated from Nigeria to Detroit. He opened a restaurant called Revolver in 2013, and then when it closed, he hit the road. He took his discomfort food concept all around the country with a dinner series he called Blackness in America. Tunde Wei has returned to his second home of Detroit for the series of pop-up dinners, and he is with us now. The discomfort food, where the experience is tailored not to your palate, but to your privilege. What does that mean, Tunde?
If you go to restaurants right now, if you go to like a nice fancy restaurant, generally folks there are trying to, they want to know who you are, what you like, right? So if it's your birthday, they come out with a cake, sing you happy birthday, all right? So we are already eating according to our privilege. That's already happening. So
and right? Even in the way the chef writes the menu.
Exactly. The places that we go to are places that we can afford to go to. Mm-hmm. And so I think my work is about highlighting that. I think a lot of times the spaces that we eat in, there's a lot of concealment of what is happening. We're just focused on the food and what's on the plate, but we don't often question why, like how the food got there and who made the food and who probably has to suffer for that food to be there, you know? So the dinners that I'm doing and the other events that I'm doing here are about sort of like showing what happens before the food, you know?
Yeah, to understand the story of what's on the plate.
Yeah.
How would that work? First of all, tell us the name of this pop-up restaurant that you're going to be doing at Bank Sui.
So I will tell you the name or where it was inspired from.
Yes.
Right. So in the 1800s, a woman from South Africa was taken to Europe and she was paraded as some sort of circus freak attraction. And because she had wide hips, big breasts, and a big backside, and she became the excuse for a certain kind of biological discrimination. White folks at the time used her body as an example of why whites were superior to black folks. And her name is Sotke Bartman. And so I sort of like took her name and I used it for this series because what she represents among many things is the exploitation of black folks, but also the invisibilization of us as well. And so I wanted to make clear and make visible all the things that we should be talking about at the table, but we don't.
So give me an idea of what will happen if I come to dinner at Bank Sui while you have this pop-up restaurant, Sartke, going on, again, May 2nd through May 5th. So what will happen? How will it be different from going out to dinner in any other place?
Well, A lot of what is going to happen, I can't say.
Okay.
Because
you want the element of surprise.
Yeah. I mean, it's not going to be crazy, but it's going to be necessary in this space. The idea for the pop-up and the idea for the other events that I am doing is to explore power. And so in this space, we're going to talk about what it means to transform communities in a more sustainable way. I think currently we're invested in a paradigm that is more concerned with profit making, or we're invested in a sort of philanthropic a model that is about control. You know, like how can somebody outside of a community decide what the community needs? So we want to talk about communities owning their resources and decisions. And with that, or how that plays out in the dining room, folks will have to just come and find out.
To come and see. What kind of food are you going to serve?
Delicious food, first of all. But I'm Nigerian. I cook Nigerian food. I think the menu is going to be some staples from where I'm from. So jollof rice, plantains, we're doing duck soup, stuff like that.
And then this broad experience of...
Yeah, I know I'm being super vague.
Because you don't want to take the curtain, you want to draw the curtains apart too quickly.
Yeah, it's important for me to like create a universe in this space, right? A universe that like is disconnected from what's happening outside of the space so that people are immersed in the experience.
Now, you were part of Detroit's restaurant scene with Revolver in 2013. When you look at it now, I know you've been traveling around and you've been in a lot of other cities, so you've got some perspective. When you look at Detroit's restaurant scene now, what do you see?
I think like I've had the opportunity to be nominally successful. So people know my name. Some people. And I say that to say, I got an email from an agent in New York, and she said, there's a book coming out, and I want you to write a blurb for the book. This agent she's wonderful, you know, has tremendous power in the food scene. And the book is being written by a lady who is a cook, a chef in Detroit. She's pretty popular, and she's also a wonderful person. She's white. And my response to the agent was, you know, Detroit is an 80% black city. And there's so many amazing, talented black people cooking and serving food. But very few of them getting that sort of recognition. And I said, if I have any social capital, at least enough for somebody from New York to email me to write a blurb, I would rather reserve that capital and apply it towards a person of color. So when I think of Detroit's food scene, I think of whiteness and white people. It is problematic that a scene that represents a city that is overwhelmingly black is overwhelmingly white. And I think this is something that we all have to think about. It's not sustainable. You can't create a sustainable, diverse community when you don't have diversity in the community, or you don't even have representation.
And how do you do that then? How do you change what is?
Well, we first have to acknowledge that it's a problem. You know, I don't hear a lot of folks in the Detroit food scene acknowledging that it's a problem. I mean, some folks do, but I think we need to say that more and more and more. Like, we need more money going to black restaurant owners in Detroit. We need more black folks in the magazines, in the newspapers. We need agents signing black folks to write books. You know, we need a spectrum of responses, but we first need to acknowledge that there's a problem.
What do you hope people will take away if they come to Sartka at Hamtramck and have a meal and an experience that you're designing to be an experience of discomfort, to push people out of their silos?
Yeah, so I want to say that the dinners aren't designed to make people uncomfortable, right? They're designed to make people realize what the problems are and maybe spur some action. And discomfort just happens to be the byproduct of the learning, you know? So I was telling a friend that, you know, you go to the gym not to have sore muscles, but to get a workout. And the sore muscles just happen to come with that.
The sweat, the sore muscles.
Exactly.
That part,
so I don't want to have people uncomfortable just because, but I do want people to continue the work, to continue to learn and to be aware and to grow. And my dinners or my events aren't magic. They're not going to change your life, you know, but they could be one part of many things that you do continuously to begin to address these questions.
Well, you can get information on Tunde Ways Sartge at the website. It's saartj.com. saartj.com. You can get all the details and tickets by going to that website. Tunde Way, thank you so much for sharing your work with us.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
Still to come, a Holocaust survivor's story of forgiveness and bearing witness.
The change was a realization of the responsibility to be a witness, to provide testimony, to allow people to learn what really happened.
Stay with us. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Some 11 million people were killed during the Holocaust. Those who survived have lived so long, they're now watching the world forget. A recent poll finds 66% of American millennials don't know what Auschwitz is. 22% had not heard of the Holocaust, or they weren't sure if they had. So there is fresh urgency in recording and remembering survivor stories. Stories like Irene Hasenberg Butters. In the spring of 1943, Irene and her family were ordered out of their Amsterdam apartment, loaded into a cattle car, sent to a holding camp, and then eventually transported to Bergen-Belsen, the concentration camp where some 50,000 people died. Irene Butter tells her story of survival and forgiveness in her new memoir, Shores Beyond Shores, From Holocaust to Hope, My True Story, co-authored by John D. Bidwell and Chris Holloway. Irene Butter is Professor Emerita of Public Health at the University of Michigan, where she founded the Raoul Wallenberg Project. Irene Butter, welcome to Stateside.
Thank you, Cynthia.
Tell us about the Hasenbergs, about your family. How many of you were there? You were living in Berlin at the beginning of your book.
Right, yes. My father came from a large family. He had five brothers and three sisters. And strangely enough, he is the only one who perished in the Holocaust. Several of them were in camps. Several of them emigrated from Germany to South America, some to the United States. Some stayed in Germany, hidden. So I really don't understand why he was the one that didn't make it.
And there was yourself, your brother, and mom and dad.
And my grandparents.
And your grandparents, that's right, who helped you plant things. We learn about this little girl's life, and you were just five when you asked your mother, what is the black zigzag on all of those flags? The first time you noticed the swastika on the Nazi flag?
Right, yes.
And how did she respond to...
She didn't want me to see them. She said, look away, it's not important.
And I know that your family wound up fleeing Berlin for Amsterdam, hoping that that would be a safe enough distance. But very quickly, as we see in your memoir, it was not a safe distance, and the Nazi noose steadily tightened around your family. How many changes did you have to go through as a little girl going to school? What did those restrictions feel like?
They were oppressive. Actually, we didn't experience... Well, my grandfather owned a bank, and that was taken away from him in Berlin. So that's why we went to Holland. My father was looking for a job because he was unemployed, and jobs were very difficult to find for Jews at that point. Then we came to Amsterdam, and we had two really wonderful years, except there was a lot of tension. because Jews were being persecuted already, and some who managed to leave Germany stopped in Amsterdam on their way to other places. But still, it was a time of uncertainty. Then in 1940, the Germans invaded, and then Holland became an occupied country, and the Nazi regime took over all the rules and all the regulations.
And as a little girl, how did that change your life? What were some of the rules and regulations that have affected you?
Well, it was very difficult. We had a curfew. We were barred from all public places. Theaters, movies, parks, libraries, swimming pools. That was the first restriction. Then we couldn't be in the homes of non-Jewish people, and they couldn't visit us. My best friend was not Jewish, so we could only play together out on the street. Then we couldn't buy food. We were not allowed to enter the food stores till 3, after 3, and it was war. So there wasn't much left at that time. We had to wear the Star of David, the Jewish star, at all times. So there was no question about who was Jewish and who was not. We were evicted from the public schools, had to go to Jewish schools. And then the deportation started. So that, of course, was the worst.
And we see this through the eyes, through your eyes as a very small child, that people just started going away, and it was like waiting for the shoe to drop. I should note you actually knew Anne Frank because she lived near you in Amsterdam?
Well, I knew who she was. I didn't actually know her well. I knew her through mutual friends. She was 2 years older and went to a different school.
That's stunning. And I know, as we learn in your book, you actually met up with her again briefly while you were both in Bergen-Belsen. The deportation order finally comes for your family in June 1943. And there you were, all loaded onto a cattle car for transport to Camp Westerbork. What do you most remember about that train trip and that car?
Well, that was pretty horrible. It was a very hot day to begin with. Everything we took with us, we had to carry. And we were stuffed into these wagons, these cattle car wagons, 60, 70, 80 people. No air, no water, no toilets.
One bucket, right?
Yes. So it was pretty gruesome. I learned only later that many people who were deported to the east, to the death camps, were in those cars for 5-6 days. And that just seems unimaginable to me, how one could survive.
We have a sense in reading and learning about the Holocaust of families being split up and sundered in the process. But the four of you managed to stay together in that first transit camp and also at Bergen-Belsen. Looking back, does that fact surprise you, that you were able to stay together as a family of four?
Well, I don't think... I didn't expect anything else, you know, because I didn't know what was going on. We had very little information about anything. But I think one reason was that my father had managed to get these South American passports, Ecuadorian passports, and that changed our status. We were not just Jews. We were exchange Jews. And we were in a separate camp in Bergen-Belsen. Bergen-Belsen had 8 camps. And we were in the camp where most of the inhabitants had some sort of passport, citizenship, or visa to another country. And the Germans wanted to capitalize on that because they could get their German citizens back, they thought. So that, I think, was one reason. And when we left Westerbork, we were told, you're going to Bergen-Belsen, it's a better camp, and you won't be there long because you're going to be exchanged. None of that was true.
No, because in February 1944, you went to Bergen-Belsen, so there you were in Germany, and they told you it was going to be a better camp. What was it really as far as the change in your daily life?
It was very dismal, and we saw it as we entered the camp. It was terrible. It was grim. It had barbed wire fences. People were at the fences. They were emaciated. They wore rags. They looked angry, sick. So we could tell right away, this isn't going to be better.
If you were to think of your time at Bergen-Belsen, what sight, sound, smell, what best sums up that time to you?
Smell, for sure. Yeah, something I've taken with me for the rest of my life. The toilets were outhouses. They were never cleaned. There were just holes in a bench. People in the barracks, if they couldn't make it to the outhouse, you know what happened. I think we had 2 showers in 1 year. There were no showers in the barracks, only big public showers that they could take you to, but didn't. No soap, no hot water. Clothes were filthy. And just illness.
And they kept piling in more people. I know at the end of July 1944, there were about 7,300 prisoners interned in Bergen-Belsen. By early 1945, it was 22,000. How did that overcrowding affect the way that people were towards each other?
Well, it affected us physically because we were being moved into different barracks all the time. And then they, the beds were bunk beds, narrow, steel-framed, three decks, and then 2 persons to each bed. So my brother and my father had 1 bed, my mother and I had 1, but it was just a narrow bed. And then people were all around you in the beds, and this kind of crowding, you know, with lice. Mm-hmm. Lice are the transmitters of disease. And everybody had lice, all you couldn't get rid of them. They nested in our clothing, and there was no way.
And it's clear from the stories you tell in your memoir, Shores Beyond Shores, it was open game. Theft, if you had a piece of something and somebody else saw it, they thought nothing of taking it away from you. It makes me wonder, did you ever in your time at either camp, Irene Butter, did you ever witness any expression of humanity from the Nazis or from the Jewish prisoners who helped them run the camps?
Well, from the Nazis, I didn't, but my father said he once got a cigarette from a soldier, once. But I didn't see any humanity around me. If they were in an aggressive mood, they could do anything. They could beat you up. They could shoot you. You were scared all the time. Every moment was uncertain, and anxiety reigned.
And then from the Jewish prisoners who ran the camps, there's one in particular that really bedeviled you. And I have to note, there's a beautiful grace note at the end of your book where you tell us you did use a pseudonym for one of the people who made your life very, very hard in that first camp, saying this person was one of my first lessons in understanding and forgiveness. I honor that by giving her and her descendants anonymity.
Mm-hmm.
What was your key to reaching that level of forgiveness?
Well, I didn't know at first. She really had it out for me and my family. She was alone. She was, her husband had died, I think. Her children weren't with her. And I imagined myself being alone.
The idea that you got out of the camp through an exchange, I think will be startling to a lot of people who kind of assumed that everybody was just kept, and that we'll be surprised to realize that the Nazis released anyone for any reason. But you got out because of that Ecuadorian passport.
Right. It was a prisoner exchange. We got out because German citizens came in. Some prisoners maybe, I don't know, but most of them were internees in Texas, in a camp in Texas. And so it was more important to the Nazis to get these people back to help fight the war than to kill a few more Jews.
So you did get out, and you need to read Irene's book to see the fascinating story of her trip through Algeria. No parents, no brother at that point. You were on your own. But you eventually get to the United States. You marry. You went on to have a distinguished career in academia, professor emerita now of public health at the University of Michigan. As you were building your new life in the United States, did you talk openly about surviving the Holocaust or stuff it away?
For 4 decades, I didn't talk. Many others didn't talk. My family and I didn't talk about it, hardly ever.
So what changed?
The change was a realization of the responsibility to be a witness, to provide testimony, to allow people to learn what really happened. And so that's how I began talking to schools, in schools, to many, many students over a long period of time. That actually was one of the motivations to write the book. Someday, if I can't go to schools anymore, then my story will be available.
I'm talking with Irene Butter, whose memoir is Shores Beyond Shores, From Holocaust to Hope, My True Story. When you look, Irene, at where we are in 2018, neo-fascists emerging in Europe, a white national subculture thriving on the internet that is actually now out in the open. You think of Charlottesville last August with neo-Nazis parading openly. When you saw those images from Charlottesville, people openly waving that swastika flag and shouting, "Jews will not replace us," in blood and soil, did you expect to face those images again in your lifetime?
Never. Certainly not in this country. And that's why I am glad that my book is coming out now, because had I written it 20 years ago, it wouldn't be as relevant as it is today. And I think it's an illustration of how history repeats itself. And we've used the phrase never again for so long now, but never again doesn't happen unless we fight for it. And that's why I think it's so important that young people learn, become aware of the consequences of authoritarianism, white supremacy, ethnic cleansing, all these concepts. They should have been wiped out a long time ago, but here they are again.
And here we are with the Anti-Defamation League, the ADL, telling us that in 2017, anti-Semitic incidents were up nearly 60% from the previous year. In fact, late last summer after Charlottesville, an ABC Washington Post poll found 9% of Americans believe it is acceptable to hold neo-Nazi views. What do you see at work here in our country to have this climate?
Well, it's a good question. I think it's fostered. You know, it was kind of underground for a long time. It wasn't acceptable.
Living on the internet.
Wasn't politically correct to have these views. And now it's allowed to express itself.
Why?
Why? Because I think one reason is racism. And there's also a great deal of dissatisfaction amongst people who see the country getting wealthier and wealthier, and their economic status is in decline, and it hasn't been addressed properly, as it should be.
So let's blame them, whatever, the air quotes around the them, for that inequality. Does that echo things that history tells us were spoken in the 1930s and the 1920s?
Definitely. We have to talk to them.
Is that how we keep the world from forgetting?
Well, at least it's an attempt. It's an effort. If we don't, I don't know what else would happen that would change it.
Irene Butter is going to be at the downtown branch of the Ann Arbor Library. It's coming up Tuesday, May 8th at 7 p.m., talking about her book, Shores Beyond Shores, From Holocaust to Hope, My True Story. And you can always find out more by going to her website, irenebutter.com. Powerful book, powerful story. It is wonderful to have you as living testimonial that forgiveness and survival are a beautiful thing.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for being with us. Support for arts and culture coverage comes in part from the Michigan Council for Arts and Cultural Affairs. On tomorrow's Stateside, schools all around Michigan are turning out the latest crop of graduates, many of whom take their skills and leave the state.
When you're just a sophomore in the business school and you're going to these organization meetings, people are like, well, I went to Chicago or I went to New York, so come along with me. And that's how it happens.
Putting the brakes on brain drain next Stateside. Today's Stateside was directed by Lindsay Scullin and engineered by Bob Scon. Stateside's executive producer is Joe Lindstroth. Contributors are Allie Billings, Mike Blank, Sarah Leeson, and Mercedes Mejia. Stateside is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so very much for listening.